choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Can I be locked? Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby lights, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 184 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Apollo 9, The Return. We ended the previous episode, number 183, shortly after the return of the lunar module to the command module. The last piece of the complicated moon program had been proven. The United States could fly those complicated spacecraft to the moon, land the lunar module, launch again, and rendezvous. All the machines worked, and so did the humans in mission control and the astronauts. I have a clip here with the assessment of the lunar module test flight from the perspective of Grumman and Downey.
8 years ago, the United States space program committed itself to a plan for landing a man on the moon, which involved sending a spaceship up to the moon, going into moon orbit, and then detaching a ferry ship to go from the moon orbiting mothership down to the surface of the moon, and after exploration on the moon, taking the astronauts back to the mothership in moon orbit, and then coming home. Today, 8 years later, that concept was proved out with the first manned flight of the Grumman Lunar Excursion Module, which Jim McDivitt and Rusty Schweikert have just flown for 6 hours, tested all of its systems, proved out that it can indeed go to the moon's surface, get off again, and re-rendezvous with a mother ship. Scott McCloud is a test astronaut for the Grumman Aircraft Engineering Company out at Bethpage, Long Island. He's been helping us out through this flight in a mock-up of the lunar module with our CBS News correspondent, Steve Rowan. Scott, through this whole 6 hours of maneuvering today, you've been following each of the maneuvers as you have been training with the astronauts on those maneuvers. How do you think it all went?
Oh, we're happy as a clam, Walter. Everything went very successful, and I think we proved all of the work that has gone on for the past years.
Was there any point of the flight, Scott, that in its actual execution today seemed hairier than had been anticipated?
No, I don't believe so. I think everything went pretty well according to plan and according to schedule. Probably the only differences were the flight planning, as Steve and I had been discussing earlier.
Walter, you noticed perhaps in the rendezvous maneuvers that they were actually about 5 miles or so below what the flight plan said in the LEM, but then the command module was in a different place too, wasn't it, Scotty?
Yes, I think the difference there is because of the real-time flight planning, in that what they're interested in doing is the burns of the descent, the ascent engine, and the RCS maneuvers, and not necessarily hitting a specific point in space, excuse me, except for that point when they come back to the command module.
The LEM crew then doesn't really worry about where it is in relationship to the Earth.
No, just the heat shield.
And out of Downey, California, where they build the command module, which has proved out so well now in three flights of the Apollo program, this the Apollo 9. Leo Krupp is the test astronaut for North American Rockwell. And Leo, it looked like it went mighty well up to now, hasn't it?
Certainly has, Walter, and it was very nice to have the whole orchestra together for a change, and I thought the music that the lunar module and the command module played was certainly beautiful.
You're getting poetic, Leo.
Thank you, sir.
I think space flight perhaps inspires that in men, and particularly those of you who work so closely with the program and indeed are the program for manned flight. Leo, does that little dock latching indicator problem give you any concern for the future?
No, sir. I think that was probably just a case of of Dave not holding the switch to the extend release long enough. So he pushed the limb away, but he came off of the switch before the limb actually separated, so the docking latches were still holding the two vehicles together. And the fact that he was able to get it back in the right configuration leads me to believe this was the problem. So I'm sure that won't happen again.
Well, I understand that even though that closing rate is around 15 hundredths of a mile per hour, which is mighty slow, there's still a pretty good jolt when the two spacecraft come together.
Well, there is a little disturbance, especially when the vehicles are light like they are now. Now, in the transposition and docking, the S-4B was attached, and we had a very heavy vehicle, so we didn't have too much. But now it's like two very light sports cars coming together, so you will get a little disturbance. But as soon as he makes contact, McDivitt would go ahead and thrust on in to keep the probe from bouncing out, to make sure he pushes it into the funnel to get a capture latch, which he did very nicely.
Back in the lunar module, McDivitt and Swigert prepared to leave the ascent stage for the last time. Here's the clip.
McDivitt and Swigert will leave this spacecraft, which has proved out remarkably well in its very first test.
Three, you're three. Proceed into the tunnel here when I get spread away. Okay, Dave, we'll start getting ready for the on the event. Okay, why don't you take a break for a while? Well, we still got a lot to do. Man, when I take a break, I'm going to bed for 3 days.
Right.
Houston, you get that?
Roger, this is Houston, copy.
They actually can go to bed practically for 3 days. They'll have
we
very little to do.
3 days off.
The remaining 5 days of this flight before they return to work. McDivitt and Swigert.
That was Jim McDivitt.
Hard day's work, and it looked real good, Truth.
Thank you, Smokey. I made it. Truth, you still there?
Jim, we've still got you for about another minute here.
Okay, well, listen, I hope the whole world's listening, but I tell you, I think we got the greatest set of flight controllers that we could have. Is there any place that we could be found? But, I'd like to thank you all. I'm sure the guys up here would, too.
Spider, we copy. Thank you very much.
Swigert and McDivitt shortly will be climbing back into the command module, and then they will cut loose the very successful Grumman lunar module to take off into a much higher orbit, firing its engines until depletion of fuel. The lower stage is circling the Earth at about 180 or 200-mile orbit, something like that, and will probably re-enter in about a month's time.
Even before crawling back into the command module, McDivitt said he was tired and ready for a 3-day holiday. Another 140 hours would pass before touchdown in the Atlantic, but the crew had achieved more than 90% of the mission objectives. There were still things to do, such as making more service module burns, a total of 8 throughout the flight, and of course, jettisoning the ascent stage. Ground control radioed a firing signal to park the lunar module in a 6,965 by 235 kilometer orbit. The crew watched the departing craft a while and then settled down to the more mundane task of checking systems, conducting navigation sightings, and taking pictures. After the mission reached T plus 10 days, it was just about time to return. Here's Walter Cronkite with the coverage of Apollo 9's re-entry.
Good morning, and this is the day that Apollo 9 comes home. The spacecraft is now out over the western coast of Australia on its last revolution of the Earth. In another half hour, over Hawaii at 11:31:14 BST. 14 seconds after 11:31, and that's just after dawn in Hawaii, David Scott, the command module pilot, will fire the service propulsion system engine to slow down the Apollo 9 and to let it drop out of orbit. It'll go through the searing heat of reentry at some 2,700 degrees, and from that height of 240 miles up and some 6,200 miles from its landing spot, eventually will drop into the Atlantic 1,000 miles south-southeast of where it started at Cape Kennedy. 10 days and 1 hour and 4 million miles ago. At that landing area, 350 miles northwest of Puerto Rico, 376 miles northeast of Grand Turk Island in the Bahamas, the helicopter ship, The Guadalcanal is standing by to receive the Apollo 9. The weather there, 2,000 feet high. There are some scattered clouds, more at 12,000 feet high. 10 miles visibility, though, light variable winds, waves 1 to 2 feet high, swells 6 to 8 feet, the temperature 73 degrees. And that's just about perfect for the splashdown of a spacecraft. Some 480 miles north to south of Bermuda, where the spacecraft would have landed at the end of 150 orbits, which was originally planned, there is still a large storm system, and waves are said to be as high as 12 feet there. So the astronauts are very pleased indeed that they're coming back at this new landing zone off Grand Turk Island. Aboard the helicopter ship Guadalcanal, we have color cameras to bring you pictures, we hope, of the arrival, the splashdown of the Apollo 9 spacecraft. Aboard the Guadalcanal are correspondents who will give us a word picture even as we watch these sensational pictures. That's a beautiful picture from the Guadalcanal right now. And let's hear first from Ron Nesson aboard the USS Guadalcanal.
The weather is splendid here at the Apollo landing point, 315 miles northeast of San Juan, 743 miles southeast of Cape Kennedy. In fact, the weather is so good that the skipper of this Apollo recovery ship, Guadalcanal, says the retrieval of the astronauts is not even going to be exciting. Captain Roy Sutter took one look at the calm seas and bright sunshine this morning and said the recovery will be mundane and routine because the perfect weather took all the romance out of it. The skipper plans to position his ship just a half mile from where the astronauts should splash down and then maneuver in even closer to give the worldwide television audience a close-up view of the recovery. Visibility stretches 10 miles all the way to the horizon, so the parachute should be visible if the spacecraft is on target. Just a slight breeze, 12 miles an hour, is rippling the sea in long, gentle swells. The Guadalcanal's five helicopters are getting ready to take off for their recovery station. Murray Thompson is on the flight deck to describe activities there. 24 hours ago, anyone standing on this deck risked being blown away by high waves, storms, and winds. But today there's a good chance you might get a sunbath. The flight deck is an array of colors, each color representing a different job for each of the men taking care of the helicopter. The Guadalcanal is turned into the wind now to give five rescue helicopters perfect launch into the air. They should be airborne any time now. Two other helicopters are standing by here on the deck in case there is an emergency. Mechanical failure or anything like that, perhaps an injury to the pilot. The rescue helicopters will fan out over a recovery area, but because of full business, we are so confident these days that the back is. The searchers are smaller in numbers and closer into the recovery ship than ever before. Two of the helicopters will be 8 miles away, another will be 4 miles off, and two will circle just about overhead, orbiting the Guadalcanal. Each helicopter carrying a four-man crew and a three-man team of broadcast. The primary helicopter, number 54, also has on board the chief NASA doctor for the recovery, Dr. Clarence Jernigan, and he may go into the water. Helicopter blades are now turning over, and we could have launch here in a very few moments.
So the helicopters are taking off from the Guadalcanal to await the arrival of the Apollo 9 spacecraft, which should be dropping out of the skies just about on target there, it is hoped, in some 53 minutes from now, 51 minutes from now. The seas look calmer, and the winds look certainly as calm as had been predicted, and the pictures down from downrange. These are beautiful pictures. The Guadalcanal is the only ship in the immediate area of this recovery. There are no outlying destroyers, as had been the case in previous landings. So confident now has the space program become, and the Navy, that the spacecraft are going to come down right on target. They have been throughout the Apollo and the Gemini mission. Few have missed by more than 2 or 3 miles. This accounted for by the fact that Gemini and now Apollo have a guiding capability. There is a small lift built into their heat shield, and they can guide themselves to a certain extent into a landing. And with the computer calculations of just when they should be firing their engines, and that small guidance capability, they've been bringing these spacecraft down right on target. With this great visibility today, we should hope to see the three great parachutes blossom out from the spacecraft
dropping the spacecraft slowly into the water near the Guadalcanal. Weather has been a problem in the last couple of days of this flight. It was not up to then, but certain minimums are required for a safe landing, of course. The winds cannot be too high, the waves cannot be too high for the, while the Apollo 9 spacecraft, any Apollo spacecraft will float, it's not a very good boat and could put the crew into a pretty uncomfortable condition. Weather consultant Gordon Barnes is with us in our studio here in New York and can tell us something about our weather problems and how it looks today.
Well, Walter, they're certainly a lot better today than they have been. Out over the Atlantic, a storm system that dumped some 2 to 4 inches of snow on the northeastern states just 1 week ago today is still stalled out in the Atlantic, halfway between Newfoundland and Ireland, and shows no signs of moving. And in the upper right-hand corner of your picture, you'll notice a large band of cloudiness that dominates not only the northeastern states, but also a portion of the Atlantic Ocean. Those clouds will remain in that area for at least another 24 to 36 hours, so that it was necessary to move the recovery area. Reports that we have from the original recovery area this morning, that is some 280 miles south-southwest of Bermuda, indicate that seas are still running some 10 to 12 feet high, very gusty northwesterly winds, 15 to 30 knots. In fact, we even have 30-knot winds here in the New York area. But downrange, where they will now recover the astronauts near the USS Guadalcanal, conditions are really very, very perfect, and maybe today, Walter, for the first time for me anyway, we'll be able to see the parachutes live and in living color.
Yes, we've seen them before, but at great distance, and I think we didn't have color at those in the earlier pictures, as I recall. It's nice to know the weather is good down there, Gordon. I'd hate to think those fellows on the Soviet trawler getting the bouncing around they must have gotten before. I wonder, actually, if they made it. I haven't heard a report that they were able to keep up with the Guadalcanal on the run down from the Bermuda site. You know, we have had Russian trawlers, which are, in effect, believed to be, and almost certainly are, spy ships well-equipped with electronic gear to watch the landings of our spacecraft ever since we first embarked on the space program, and there is one of them, there has been one of them along up to now. It was up in the Bermuda area, just 5 miles off the fantail of the Guadalcanal, and traipsing right along, kind of a little bird dog there, flapping along behind our prime recovery ship. I haven't heard yet whether it was able to make the fast run on south to the new recovery zone. It might have thrown the Russian plans off considerably.
Well, Walter, on our ship reports that we receive here at our Space Weather Center, we don't get the Russian troller reports. We get everything but.
CBS News color coverage of the flight of Apollo 9 will continue in a moment.
On March 13, 1969, after 151 revolutions in 10 days, 1 hour, and 1 minute, Apollo 9 splashed down safely in the Atlantic northeast of Puerto Rico, completing a 6 million kilometer flight that had cost an estimated $340 million. Less than an hour later, the crew was deposited by helicopter aboard the carrier USS Guadalcanal. Here's how the splashdown and recovery was reported by Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. The three Apollo 9 astronauts are safely aboard the helicopter carrier Guadalcanal tonight. A pinpoint splashdown in the Atlantic, 300 miles north of Puerto Rico, climaxed their 10-day space mission. Here's how the recovery went.
A report from the command post on the ship that it is 3 miles. 3 miles away. Not the closest landing by a spacecraft, but very accurate indeed. Guadalcanal has talked to the astronauts inside their spacecraft by radio. And as the loudspeaker on the ship just announced to the crew, the astronauts are in good shape. The Recovery 3 helicopter is just over the spacecraft now. That's the main recovery helicopter, the first team. The spacecraft is in the water. 1 minute after noon in the Atlantic, and there's the helicopter.
That splashed down exactly on the second.
Piloted by the
We've never seen this before. We've never had such a close-up to actually watch the hatch open.
Now I have NBC's perspective on the egress from the capsule.
Almost close enough now to jump in there and virtually touch them. see the frogmen on the outside of the craft. I think the wind is picked up. Fresh air to breathe for the first time in 10 days. There's somebody coming out. Let's see if we can see through binoculars who it is. One astronaut is, sort of took a little stumble into the life raft. He's fine. He's got a yellow life belt around his waist. Oh, now he changed his life raft. I guess the orange one is to drop into when you get out of the hatch, and then you move on to the yellow one to wait to be picked up by the helicopter. Can't see from here which one of the astronauts was the first out. There's the second. And he's out. He's asking directions. He looks like he's got two balloons on his... Life raft tipped up on end. But he's fine. He just... One more astronaut still inside the spacecraft. And the frogman seemed to be spending just a moment or two making that orange life raft a bit more stable. Helicopter 54 moving in now and lowering the Billy Pugh net. You'll see about rolling in. He rolled in. Is that Scott? Scott?
There's a message that's just been relayed here. Aircraft high above trying to talk to the Guadalcanal to pass on a message from the White House to the astronauts when they arrive on the ship. So perhaps we'll have a phone call from President Nixon, or at least a contact and message of congratulations on their safe arrival back after their historic mission.
The first astronaut has been pulled up into Commander Rankin's helicopter. That was Colonel Scott. And the basket is coming down to get the next one. Some of the equipment that these helicopters have in them, electronic equipment for their normal work of anti-submarine detection, has been removed to make more room inside for the astronauts and for the homing device, which locked in and directed them to the spacecraft.
They're running a little bit behind their anticipated schedule, about 45 to 46 minutes after splashdown, and we're certainly towards the end of this rescue as far as getting the astronauts aboard.
We are just about at the end of the pickup. Colonel McDivitt is in the helicopter now. All three astronauts are in the helicopter. Scott first, then Schweikert, now McDivitt. And the helicopter will be coming back to the deck for the welcome ceremony.
In case you missed the exit order, that was Scott first, Schweikert second, and McDivitt third. Here's a clip with the helicopter landing on the Guadalcanal and McDivitt's comments on the flight.
Here's Colonel McDivitt, first man out. Schweikert and Scott near them. Ben James, the NASA Public Affairs Officer at the foot of the stairway. Okay. Astronauts are coming out now and chatting with James. They look pretty well. Dr. Jernigan behind them. Some beards. They're being asked now to step up and say a few words to Jim McDivitt. All caps on. And it says, Guadalcanal, astronaut.
Well, it's certainly been a long time since we left land. And obviously, I don't have my sea legs or my land legs either. But it's sure good to be back. Matter of fact, I think you guys kept us here in the Guadalcanal, kept us going the last few days. We heard you had a big cake here, and every night when we were eating our evening meal, we discussed how much of the cake we're going to eat. As a matter of fact, I don't think we ate very much the last couple of days just getting ready for it. We've had a real good time, and I hope we accomplish something worthwhile. The whole space program is made up of just thousands of people. We're just a very small part of it, and you guys are really A-number-one for us. Thanks to everybody who's helped.
Then the debriefings and celebrations began. At a ceremony in Washington, with an address by Vice President Agnew, Lunar Module Development leaders Carol Bolender of the Manned Spacecraft Center and Llewellyn Evans of Grumman were given the NASA Exceptional Service Medal and NASA Public Service Award, respectively. Apollo 9 was a very successful flight, but there were some improvements that could be made. The lunar module performance was more than sufficient, but there were still some nagging problems with some of the instruments and with some of the mission control's procedures. During the flight, controllers had improvised over and over again, passing along instructions to McDivitt and Swigert to do this or that differently, or to work around something that just wasn't right. But of course, that was one of the reasons NASA flew Apollo 9, to find the bugs and to fix them. Flight director Gene Kranz wrote in his book that several times during the mission, he reached task saturation while controlling two spacecrafts and planning and executing the mission. Kranz was convinced that the only way to ensure effective support for spacecraft operation when the lunar module and command module were separated in lunar orbit was with two separate teams in mission control, one following the command module and the other following the LEM. Two complete communication sets were already available at each console to support shift handover, so the hardware was in place. The dual flight director arrangement would be tested on Apollo 10. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 184 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Apollo 9, The Return. I want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. New listeners, make sure you sign up for the email list and connect with me on Twitter and Facebook. And you can do all that on the homepage, spacerockethistory.com. Today, we salute the second most popular level of donation, which is the Mercury level. Currently, there are 43 Mercury donors so far this year. Mercury donors give $20 or more during the calendar year. Thanks for your contribution and support, Mercury donors. I had a couple of afterthoughts this week. First, I do have a big announcement, one that many of you might have been waiting for. iTunes had a shift in policy, in their search policy, so I have been able to get all episodes for the entire Space Rocket History Podcast linked on iTunes. So if you've been waiting to download those, now's a good time. And it's all free on iTunes. Episodes 1 through 184 should be there. And they are there on my computer, and several of the listeners have checked too, and they are there. So you should be able to find all episodes on iTunes now. Before I forget, I wanted to let everyone know the current location of the Apollo 9 command module, call sign Gumdrop, is the San Diego Air and Space Museum in San Diego, California, in case you want to go visit it. Well, a crucial mission that the U.S. had to have has been completed successfully, Apollo 9. In some respects, Apollo 9 reminds me of Apollo 7. Both missions were odd-numbered. Both have largely been forgotten. Both missions were very important, and neither of them will ever be forgotten on this podcast. When I played the clip of Walter Cronkite during re-entry, did you notice him busting the Soviets in the Russian trawler? He correctly identified them as a spy ship and compared them to a little bird dog that couldn't keep up with the American ships. I thought Walter busting the Soviets was kind of funny. If you missed that, listen to it again. During the egress from the capsule, when the astronauts were being taken out of the capsule while it was floating in the water, there was a little bit of, I don't know if I call it fun, a little bit of water fun. Some of them got a little bit wet. And I had a clip of Walter over-dramatizing that. It was just, he just went just a step too far on that one, so I did not play that one because it was kind of silly. But the crew of Apollo 9 were plenty tough enough to stand a little bit of water. They didn't melt or anything, so they did fine. Okay, I posted some pictures and the audio for this episode on the webpage at spacerockethistory.com. I hope you check that out. I was pleased to receive 5 donations to support the podcast over the past week. Patrick R. donated at the Mercury level and earned his rocket emoji. Kelly H. from Australia donated at the Gemini level. Ulrich H. from Germany donated at the Apollo level. Marco M. donated at the Gemini level and sent me some more fantastic posters for me to decorate my plush, well-lit studio. Richard H. from Michigan donated at the Mercury level. I want to thank all of you, Patrick, Kelly, Ulrich, Marco, and Richard, for donating to the Space Rocket History Podcast this week. Sadly, we lost 2 Patreon donors, so we're back down to 75. Our overall donors for the year are 187, with a goal of reaching 250 by the end of 2016. For those of you who have not donated yet, there's still time. Please keep in mind, Space Rocket History is entirely listener-supported. I depend upon your financial support to keep the podcast going. If you are enjoying the podcast and can afford to help, please do so. You don't have to donate a lot. You can make a one-time donation of $10 to be at the Vostok level, or sign up with Patreon for a $1 donation per month, sort of like a voluntary subscription. To make a one-time donation, go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and click on the orange Donate button on the right top of the page. Or you can sign up with Patreon by clicking on the Patreon link, also on the homepage, just below the Donate button. All donors are rewarded with their name on the donors page on the website, spacerockethistory.com, based on their donation level. Donors that donate 2 years in a row receive the coveted rocket emoji, and those who donate 3 years in a row receive the treasured moon emoji next to their name on the donors list. I want to encourage everyone to feel free to share the podcast. You can link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And I want to thank especially those who have retweeted, and I will recognize all of you on the next episode. This is the end of content for this episode, and I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested in this, please feel free to switch to the next podcast. Thanks for sticking around, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Next week, we will begin Apollo 10, and you don't want to miss that. In podcast news, I have some more statistics from October. I have the countries 11 through 20 in the number of downloads for the record-setting month of October. Here they are. Number 11, Netherlands. Number 12, New Zealand. Number 13, Ireland. 14, Switzerland. 15, Norway. 16, Italy. 17, Denmark. 18, Mexico. 19, Luxembourg. And 20, India. Big shout out to all those in countries 11 through 20. In personal news, we are back home in the foothills, and it's certainly nice being here back with my family, and it's a whole lot easier to do an episode back here in my plush well-lit studio. Since we last talked, I had a chance to visit the Virginia Space Museum. Now, it had the actual Apollo 12 capsule and a mock-up of the Orion capsule, and they were sitting pretty close to each other, so you could actually compare the size of both. You could see how much bigger the Orion is as compared to the Apollo 12. Now, Virginia Space Museum is a good place to take your children. There are a ton of hands-on learning exhibits there, just tailored for your children. So if you go, don't forget your kids. They'll have a good time there. Okay, that's all of the time I have for this week. I hope to have episode 185 up by next Thursday. So long for now.